Thanks, Justin. Well, good morning, everybody. Morning. Happy Wednesday. You're holding up all right? Anybody tired, sleepy? Anybody jacked up on caffeine? Do we have anybody in this room right now who is in the fifth grade or younger? If you are in the fifth grade or younger, would you mind standing up? And just stay standing up for a second. I'm going to talk to you guys in just a moment, but stay right where you are and stay standing up. Now, do we have anybody in middle school here? And would you please stand up and stay standing? Go ahead and get up. Stay on your feet. Good. So that's like 6th, 7th, 8th grade. How about the 9th grade to 12th, like high school students? Would you please rise to your feet? All right, good. Stay standing. College students, do we have any in the room? All right, good. Stay standing. Do we have anybody who just like recently graduated from college but haven't found jobs yet? Okay, up on your feet. Up on your feet. That's good. I'd like to talk to you. Anybody in that general kind of uncertain season of life? You don't have a job. You don't own a house. You don't have a significant other in your life. You are a totally available, unemployed, broke, undirected young bachelor or bachelorette. Anybody? All right. Now, stay on your feet for just a minute. I'm going to have you sit down momentarily. But here's the thing. Today, with all due respect to everybody else who's seated, you are the focus of my talk today. You are the object of my attention today. And I think the rest might get something out of it also. But they're going to be eavesdropping to a private conversation that I, as a dad of somebody your age, I'm going to have a private fatherly talk with you all, if you don't mind terribly. Your parents may mind when we're done talking because you just might get messed up today. And you might go home and say, Mom, Dad, I got messed up at the New Wilmington Mission Conference. All right, you may be seated. So here's the thing. I was in the 9th grade. I was 14 years old in Lebanon when I heard about this relationship thing with Jesus and that the desire that God has to be in a friendship with me, not just so that I feel good about myself and know that, hey, I'm loved, the Spirit of the Lord is on me, and I'm empowered, the Spirit has anointed me, but just so that my life could then make a dramatic difference in the world. I heard about that when I was 14 years old. In my first prayer, I remember vividly the very first prayer that I ever prayed, and it went like this. I was 14. Here's the prayer of a 14-year-old. God, I just want my life to count. That's what I prayed as a 14-year-old. And my hunch is that there is not anybody in this room, 14, 4, 44, 94, anywhere in between or beyond. There's not anybody in this room right now who does not want his or her life to count. None of us want our lives to be this waste that just kind of appears and evaporates and nothing happens between appearing and evaporation. All of us want our lives to count, and that's been the prayer of this life since I was 14 years old. Even when I was messing up, getting thrown out of high school, getting thrown out of college, making all sorts of regrettable choices that I wish I could undo, even then my prayer was, God, I want my life to count. How am I screwing it up? But my prayer had been and continues to be, even now at the age of 49, God, I want my life to count. That continues to be the heartbeat of this man. And my hunch is that when we think about it, it's the heartbeat of every woman and man in this room. So our junior highs gave us that cheer at the very beginning, do you want a revolution? I'm thinking like we know even how to spell revolution. Okay, so we know how to spell revolution. But do we know what a revolution looks like? And when we say we want it, do we have our seatbelts fastened? Because sisters and brothers, we are called to a revolutionary lifestyle. We are called to a lifestyle that challenges the norms that are in front of us. We are called to be the ones in this world who make decisions very differently than the way the rest of the world makes decisions. When Patty and I first came to Pittsburgh in 1984, we were challenged, and I was hired by a Presbyterian church to work with kids in that particular community. And I was challenged, she and I were challenged then, with the notion of call. What does it mean to be called? Most of us think of call as a call to an institution. I'm called to this church, this college, this job. Or we think of call maybe as a call to a vocation. I'm called to do X, and it doesn't matter what the context is. I'm going to do this thing that I'm called to do. But I was challenged then to think of call very differently. And the way we were challenged to think of call is as such. Rather than call to an institution or call to a vocation, how about being called to a people? Called to a people, the institution doesn't matter, the vocation doesn't matter, the people matter, and our call is to serve a particular population, regardless of what the job is, regardless of what the institution is, called to a people. And we were challenged then to consider a lifetime call to serve the people of the city of Pittsburgh. I was 24 years old. I was 24, and I was asked to consider making a lifetime commitment to serving the people of one particular city in North America, and I'm this little Arab boy who's just trying to figure out where to plug the umbilical cord that I unplugged from my mom 3 days before, and now I'm being challenged to give my life in service to a people in a city that is entirely strange to me. And we said yes. We naively said yes in 1984. And now in 2010, we're still on a daily basis trying to figure out what it means to live out that call. Now, there was a leader in the city of Pittsburgh at that time. Actually, he had died a few years prior. I never met him. But his influence was very keen at that time, who had a vision for the city of Pittsburgh. And his vision was this: that Pittsburgh would be more known for God than it is known for steel. That was one man's vision for his city, that Pittsburgh would be more known for God than it is known for steel. And he had gathered a handful of folks who bought onto that vision and said, yes, we want to be a part of this movement to make Pittsburgh more known for God than it is known for steel. And then that second generation of leaders were recruiting some younger folks like me, saying, would you be a part of this movement that one day Pittsburgh would be more known for God than it is for steel? And naively, I said, yep, I want to be a part of that. And I still want to be a part of that. But we started wrestling with, well, what does it mean for a city to be more known for God than for steel? Now, what we did not know then is that the steel industry in Pittsburgh is going to tank, and by default, God would win. We weren't planning on that. And that's not what any of us wanted, because in that period, in the early to mid-80s, actually all through the 80s, unemployment in Pittsburgh, in this one city alone, unemployment was in the 20%. So in other words, out of every 10 people who wanted a job, out of every 10 people who wanted a job, what's 20%? Two, thank you. I'm trying to raise $250 million. Can you believe they trust me with those kind of numbers? So out of every 10 people who wanted a job, two couldn't find one. 20%, 20 out of every 100 people could not get a job. And sometimes it ranged higher into the mid-20s, 25 out of every 100 people. So horrible, horrible season in our city's life. So what does it mean for a city to be more known for God than for steel? That's what we wrestled with. Now, people have answered that question differently. I'm going to tell you how we answered it, what that means to us. For us, a city that is more known for God than it is known for steel is this. It's a city where the most vulnerable among us aren't vulnerable anymore. It's a city, to use the biblical language, where the least among us fare well. It's impossible for a city to be known as a city of God if the least among us continue to not do well. Another way to say it: a city that is known for God, to use Old Testament language, it's a city where the widow, the orphan, and the alien fare well. So then we said, all right, we're going to give our lives in service to widows, orphans, and aliens in the city. Old people, little people, and estranged people. Old people who are afraid about what their future might look like. Little people who are scared to death by the reality of their present, and alienated people who just wonder where in this world they belong. All right, so a couple of days ago, we talked about the Spirit of the Lord is on me, and we concluded that that means I am loved, I am God's beloved daughter, I'm God's beloved son. Yesterday, the Spirit of the Lord has anointed me. That means I am empowered, I am equipped to face great challenges, to battle great temptations, and to do great work. Well, the third part in this trilogy is the Spirit of the Lord has sent me. I'm going to read this portion again. The Spirit of the Lord is on me because He has anointed me to do what? To preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners, recovery of sight for the blind, to release the oppressed, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. You and I are loved and equipped and empowered in order to be sent to places where many people have opted not to go for a very long period of time. We are called to go to people who are poor, to people who are imprisoned, to people who are blind, to people who are oppressed, and to everybody who needs to know that God favors them. We are not called in this passage, the Spirit is not on us, has not empowered us, and has not sent us to places that are comfortable, familiar, safe, places where we are entirely in charge, where our feet touch the ground, where where we are in control of our lives and our destiny. That's not what this is calling us to. Now, the reason I began by saying I want to talk to the young people in this room is this. Your parents, my generation, they have made nearly every important decision they will ever make. There are very few big decisions in front of them. Most of them are behind them. Your generation, my generation, is done making all the big decisions. Your generation hasn't even begun. What are some of the big decisions that you will make in your life? Among the biggest, who am I going to marry? Others include, where am I going to live? What am I going to do? Which political party am I going to join? What cause will I align myself with? You've not made those decisions yet. Now, you think you may have, but in all likelihood, what you've done so far is simply said, all right, if you like your parents, everything they stand for, you're going to stand for. If you don't like your parents, everything they stand for, you're opposed to. But you really haven't made any of those decisions in any kind of a meaningful way. Now, what would happen? Scott challenged us to get cross-cultural. What if we got so cross-cultural that we became dangerous revolutionaries? What would happen, friends, if you made all of those big decisions on the basis of not how those decisions impact you, but what if you made those big decisions on the basis of how they impact the world around you? What if that became the way you chose which house to buy? Because did you know that you can transform a neighborhood by buying a house in it? Take my city, for example, Pittsburgh. In my lifetime, I'm old, but not like ancient, archaic. But in my relatively short lifetime, Pittsburgh has lost over half of its population. The city proper has lost over half of the population in just 5 decades. So right now we have streets upon streets upon streets in neighborhood after neighborhood after neighborhood where there are lots of vacant properties that are boarded up, where folks have moved out much more quickly than anybody is moving in. And as a result, violence has escalated. As a result, property values have gone down. Parks and recreation are in a state of disarray. Schools are weak. Neighborhood block clubs don't exist. Churches are dwindling in their pop. What would happen if the 10 of you in the front row chose one street in one neighborhood and you each snatched up a house for $20,000, and we can find you a house for $20,000. Of course, you'd have to sink a lot more in it to get it to where you want it to be. But what if you made that choice that, you know, we're going to transform a neighborhood by doing something everybody's going to do. Everybody's going to buy a house. maybe not everybody, most people are going to buy a house. So what if we make the choice of which house we're going to buy and in what neighborhood on the basis of how that could change the neighborhood? The other way, which is the more popular way, well, let's find the house that has all the rooms that we need, add to that three or four rooms that we don't need, mortgage ourselves over our eyeballs, let's get a place that we could never in our lifetime be able to afford, in a neighborhood that we'd have to maintain a lifestyle that's beyond our abilities, let's mortgage not only ourselves, but our kids and their kids after them. How many people do you know that have a beautiful house and as a result they're house poor? Don't raise your hand because that could be you. So what would happen if we were revolutionaries and said, we're not going to follow the norm. We're not going to follow the path of least resistance. Instead, we are going to take the road less traveled. And we just might make a difference. And if we don't, we will have died trying. What if you want to be a school teacher? Great thing. I hope you become that. And I hope you are so focused on becoming a great school teacher that you settle for nothing less than transforming kids' lives as you teach. But you know, there's not a shortage of good teachers. There's not. There are lots of good teachers who are looking for jobs. But there is a shortage of good teachers who want to go to schools that aren't so good. There are two young men in my church. They're scary. They're big. They're buff. Tattoos all over, piercings all over, and when they look at you, they're just going to snarl. They're scary. They're ugly. They're mean. But they're incredible school teachers. So these two guys, along with their wives, and one of them has a wife who's a nurse, and the other one has a wife who is becoming a nurse, they decided to move into our neighborhood. And they identified the worst performing high school in Pittsburgh public schools, where teachers are trying as hard as they can to get out of. They said, well, that's where we want to teach. They went to the principal and said, we'd like to teach here. And the principal, who is equally intent on transforming that school, just not quite as ugly, said to them, I don't have any teaching jobs. They said, well, you will. You'll have teaching jobs because people are leaving the school. We know that they're leaving the school. We want two of those jobs. And they started putzing around the school, doing volunteer things and doing substitute things and just doing stuff, kind of waiting their turn. And boy, they were like kid magnets. These two scary, ugly dudes that I would not want them anywhere near my daughter are now people that I would love them to marry. Oh, they're married. And as a result, our worst performing high school in Pittsburgh is now our second worst performing school in Pittsburgh. So you want to teach? Great, teach. But why go to a place where there are 300 applicants for every job when you can go to a school where nobody wants to teach? And if you just waited a couple of months and while you're waiting, you waited tables at Eaton Park and you'll be guaranteed a job. What if you made those kinds of decisions on the basis of how your decisions would transform the world around you? My medical doctor, who is younger than me, which is weird. My doctor, he's a Yale-trained medical doctor. Have you heard of Yale Community College? Little obscure. He's a Yale medical school graduate, came to Pittsburgh to do his residency, and concluded that he's good. He's a really good doctor. And he asked himself, well, why should only people with money and great health insurance have access to great medical care? Because I'm a good doctor. And poor people who have no money nor insurance need good doctors. Don't you agree? So he opened a clinic in a neighborhood where nobody had a clinic. He opened a clinic there and got two of his buddies to start the clinic with him. Now they have about 12,000 patients. Not all of them are poor and don't have health insurance. Four of their 12,000 patients are Salim, Patty, Christina, and Nathan Gabriel. We're not poor, and we have great health insurance. But by us choosing to go to them, then our money from our health insurance helps to subsidize the rest of the clinic. So I go for a doctor's visit every other day. I do. I want to change this world. little decisions. Everybody's going to buy a house. Everybody's going to look for a job. Everybody needs a doctor. What if we just made those decisions on how our decisions impact others? And why would we even begin to think like that? Well, because the Spirit of the Lord is on us. Because the Spirit has anointed us. Because the Spirit has sent us to preach good news to who? To bring sight to who? Freedom to who? Prisoners. And release to who? Oppressed. Gotcha. All right. So we have a choice between the path of least resistance, which, by the way, those of you who are, I had breakfast with a mechanical engineer this morning. And you know about the path of least resistance. When you put a new furnace in your house and you run the ductwork is this, like, you know, these tubes that are metal. No air can go through the walls of the tubes that are metal unless you put a vent. So you punch a hole in the metal because you want the air to follow the path of least resistance, to naturally go from the furnace through the ductwork and find an opening and then go out of the opening, go to the next opening and go out of it. That's how the majority of our world makes its decisions. Where's the opening? Great, that must be God's call. When maybe, just maybe, our job is to push against the metal and to keep pushing against the metal until we puncture a hole in it so that our worst performing high school becomes our second worst performing high school and eventually our best performing high school, so that poor people who don't have access to medical care now do. So that neighborhoods that are declining in safety and in value start turning around again. What would happen? What would happen if not just the front row of, half the front row of 10, what if every row that hasn't yet bought a house made that decision, that hasn't yet picked a job made that decision, that hasn't yet chosen a doctor made that decision? What would happen? Do you think the prayer, God, I want my life to count, would be answered? It's not a trick question. The answer is yes. Absolutely yes. I have two children. My daughter is 26. She is stunning. Absolutely stunning, beautiful, mesmerizing. From the inside out, outside in, she's an amazing woman. I wonder if I'm her dad. She's an artist. After graduating from Pittsburgh Public Schools, went to New York, studied theater and film, and lives in New York, and is trying to make a difference in the world of artists in that city. My son, who is equally handsome, well, equally handsome to who? Who is handsome, who is equally smart and equally lovely. After graduating from Pittsburgh Public Schools, went to Penn State, and then he's now working in Philadelphia. But this past weekend, Friday, after work, 3-4 days ago, I hopped on a one-way flight from Pittsburgh to Philadelphia. I usually drive to Philly, but this time I flew because on Saturday, 3 days ago, I drove the U-Haul truck to move him from Philadelphia to Pittsburgh because he's starting law school in Pittsburgh this fall, and I'm thrilled about that. I don't care about law school. I'm just thrilled that he's back in town. So I'm driving the U-Haul back. I get there late Friday night. He and I go out for some ribs and burgers and no tofu that day. We had a great dinner. We went back to his apartment, had great conversation, didn't realize we had to start cleaning. So he packed and cleaned, and I was on my hands and knees scrubbing his bathroom floor and scrubbing his kitchen. Went to bed around 1 o'clock, woke up around 4, resumed the cleaning duties. 7 o'clock, we picked up the U-Haul truck. 8 o'clock, his friends were at the front door. By 11 o'clock, we had the truck loaded. By noon, we were on the road. By 6, we were at his apartment in Pittsburgh. By 6:30, two buddies in Pittsburgh showed up. By 9 o'clock, we had the truck unloaded. And by 10 o'clock, I collapsed. It felt like, I told Patty, I said, it felt like, you know, I was so excited about bringing him home. Like, you know, when we first brought him home from the hospital, I was so excited about bringing him home that, like, feeling tired just wasn't part of the formula. This time, I'm the one who went through labor, not my wife. And but I brought him home. Driving back, I'm driving the U-Haul, he's driving his car. You know, U-Haul trucks don't have, you know, like, satellite radio and fancy things. So I'm listening to AM radio. in central Pennsylvania, between Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. So there's a ton of talk radio. And by the way, I boycotted talk radio a few years ago. I refused to listen to talk radio. I succumbed to the temptation and to the lack of options, and I listened to talk radio on Saturday for 4 hours between Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. And here's what dawned on me, that if all we listen to is conservative talk radio, we would conclude that the world is going to hell in a liberal handbasket. But don't laugh too quickly. If all we listen to is liberal talk radio, we think the world is going to hell in a conservative hell basket. If we listen to Democrats, we think the world is going to hell in a Republican handbasket. If we listen to Republicans, we think the world is going to hell in a... Yeah. And here's what kind of struck me as I was listening to that and thinking about the conference. This phrase, "he has sent me." "He has sent me" means I move over. Sending is a very active thing. In talk radio, conservative or liberal, Democrat or Republican, we stay a safe distance away from those who disagree with us, and we throw rocks at them. And we hope that in so doing, we will turn them into our friends. The church does something very similar to that. Those who don't fit our standard, don't live according to our rules, don't follow our theology, whose lifestyle differs than the one we value, we put a sign on the church marquee that says, "All are welcome," while we're lobbing rocks at those who don't quite qualify. I read over the weekend in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, Paul saying these words, "To the Jew I became a Jew in order that I might win a Jew. To the Greek I became a Greek so that I might win a Greek. To those under the law I became as one under the law, even though I'm not under the law, so that I might win those under the law. And to those not under the law I became one not under the law, even though I am under the law, in order to win those that are under the law. To the weak, I became weak in order to win the weak. I have become all things to all people in order that I might save some." That is sending. That is sending. Instead of posting a sign, "Everybody welcome here," but the assumption is, you're welcome here if you look like us, act like us, believe like us, behave like us, think like us, and there's nothing different about you than us, because you know what? We just don't want to be terribly uncomfortable. Which is why 98% of our churches are either all white, all black, all Korean, all Latino, all conservatives, all liberals, all rich, all poor. It is just not convenient to mix it up. But that is disobedience. That is disobedience. The Spirit of the Lord is on me and has anointed me and has sent me to places and to people that are just outside of the norm of my comfort zone. So rather than lobbing rocks from a distance, which Paul used to do very well as a Pharisee, boy, he was a great stone thrower. But his transformation resulted in him going to the people against whom he threw stones, asking for forgiveness, and saying, "Forgive me, I repent of my sin, I love you, and my Father loves you too." So, sisters, brothers, we have an example in this. And the example, as Scott already said, is none other than Jesus. And we have a song that tells us how Jesus modeled this example, and we sing it in many of our churches and many of our youth groups. "You came from heaven to earth to what? And from the earth to the cross, so that what would happen? And from the cross to the grave, from the grave to the sky," and our response is, So we sing songs about Jesus relocating, changing his zip code, going outside of his comfort zone. We sing songs about that, and we love it, and we raise our hands, and we close our eyes and say, thank you, thank you, thank you. We lift your name on high. But then when we hear him say to us, okay, come follow me, our response is, let's sing about a revolution. I'm going to close by reading something that might surprise you from Soren Kierkegaard. He said, to want to admire instead of follow Christ, to want to admire instead of follow Christ is not necessarily an invention by bad people. No. No, it is more an invention by those who spinelessly keep themselves detached, who keep themselves at a safe distance. The call is to follow Christ. So he's sending us to places where he himself has already gone. So now really, the only choice we have is, yes, I'll follow, or forget you, Jesus, not interested. Greg and Rebecca, can I get you to help me again? You came from heaven to earth.
You came from heaven to earth to show the way from the earth to the cross, my debt to pay. From the cross to the grave, from the grave to the sky, Lord, I lift your name on high.
You came
from heaven to earth to show the way from the earth to the cross, my debt to pay. From the cross to the grave, from the grave to the sky, Lord, I lift your name on high.
Lord, I lift your name on high.
I lift your name on high.
Lift your name on high.
Lord, I love to sing your praises.
Love to sing your praises.
I'm so glad you're in my life.
So glad you're in my life.
I'm so glad you came to save us.
Came to save us.
You came from heaven to earth to show the way. From the earth to the cross, my debt to pay. From the cross to the grave, from the grave to the sky, Lord, I lift your name on high.
You came from heaven to earth to show the way.
You came from heaven to earth to show the way. From the earth to the cross, my debt to pay. From the cross to the grave, from the grave to the sky, Lord, I lift your name on high.
Lord, I lift.
Lord, I lift your name on high. Lord, I lift.